classic results. Some new results, which are also, I believe, quite solid based on matrix models and low-dimensional string theories, and finally also some speculations, which are just that, speculations, and perhaps sometimes the speculations will be mixed in with the more solid results, but I hope I will be able to disentangle them as we go along so that you can decide for yourself whether you believe my speculations or not. The theme is, to a large extent, very similar to, well, not very similar, but certainly in the same universality class as what Shiraz told you about, the gauge theory geometry correspondence. And here I made a list, a very partial list, of possible routes towards gauge theory geometry correspondence in string theory. You could have even a broader list if you relax this condition. We're talking about string theory. And the first item is the most popular one, the one that certainly has attracted the most attention in the last few years, which is the space-time picture motivated by deep brain physics. And the cartoon that you have seen drawn infinitely many times is this one. You have a stack of N deep brains, and you want to think about the physics of these deep brains in space-time, either in terms of their effect on the space-time geometry, their back reaction on the metric, or in terms of their open string degrees of freedom on their world volume. And certainly this is how historically the SFT was motivated. Of course, however, as also Shiraz was mentioning, there is a much older story which fits very nicely with this deep brain picture. And it's the old idea by Tuft that quite generically, in the large and limit of a gauge theory, one may be able to recast the gauge theory as a closing theory. And this really will be the theme of the talk, although deep brains will play a role, but not so much from their space-time, from the space-time point of view, which is usually emphasized. Rather, we will try to make precise or to give some ideas of how one may try to make precise a more microscopic point of view, in which we are really thinking about worksheet string perturbation theory, and we want to see the famous holes in the Riemann surface that correspond to having strings ending on the deep brains closing. And then I mention other items which also play a role to some extent in the material I will present, but I'm not sure how much time I will have to emphasize those aspects. And again, the old idea by Polyakov that somehow in trying to formulate a gauge theory, the string theory, we will meet this fact that we are doing non-critical string theory and the Liouville field will play the role of an extra dimension. And finally, of course, another route, which is intimately related with all the above, is trying to use loop equations and interpret them as appropriate word identities of the string theory. So these are really very general, motivational, it was a very motivational slide, and as I was saying, the main issue here is how we can understand open-closed duality from a more intrinsic microscopic point of view based on string perturbation theory. And I will try to convince in these lectures that we can actually do that very explicitly in some simple examples. And I would like to believe that this is actually how things work in general, even in concrete, realistic examples like the SFT. So let's start by reminding ourselves of this classic analysis by Tuft on how we organize the large and limit of a gauge theory. In fact, it doesn't really matter whether this is a gauge theory. In fact, very soon I will be switching to a more tractable zero-dimensional matrix models, quantum field theories in zero dimensions. All that matters here is that the fields of the theory are in the adjoint representation of some gauge group. And then, of course, as Stouff taught us, we can organize the expansion thinking of any gauge field propagator in the double line notation. I'm really starting off in the most possible elementary way. And if I have a generic action which looks like 1 over g mil squared, and there is, say, a kinetic term, I will be very schematic, plus a cubic term, and perhaps higher order terms. Let me just do this case for fun. Then, of course, I can count each, if I have a generic Feynman diagrams with V vertices, P propagators, and H Holtz, by Holtz I mean boundary components, then for each propagator I get a factor of G square, for each vertex I get a factor of minus G square, and then I get the point of the double line notation that by summing over the Champaton indices, I get a factor of n to the h. And if we remind ourselves that the Euler number of the surface, which is 2 minus 2g, is equal to v minus p plus h, we can immediately derive that famous expression. This is one of those classic, truly classic calculations which takes two lines, but they seem to teach us an enormous amount. So the old speculation, so again, I hope we are all in the same boat here. Each of these double lines is the expanded version of a gluon propagator in my gauge theory. And of course, this looks a lot like the perturbative expansion of an open string theory, in which we think of the open strings propagators as being these double lines. And the old speculation by Tuft is that perhaps somehow, as we sum over the number h of boundary of Holtz, we could somehow recast this expansion, which looks like the expansion of an open string theory, into the expansion of a closed string theory, where we have summed up the expansion in h into a single function fg of t. And of course, the whole point in the last 30 years has been to make this intuition precise. And so unless there are questions about this, which is really elementary stuff, I just want to remind you of that. I would like to get out of the way a confusion, perhaps, or a different approach to something quite different that I will really not talk about extensively. I just want to mention this possibility, which is realized in one important class of examples, but I believe not in the ones that ultimately we're interested in, namely ADS-CFT and related examples. And the intuition that that you may have here is that, well, certainly if I have a small number of volts, this doesn't really look like a closed surface. But if I keep adding more and more holes, somehow, perhaps, I'm filling in the surface. And so perhaps there is a sense in which I can extract from the theory a purely closed theory by focusing on the surface which have an infinite number of holes. And of course, this is the intuition, which is perfectly correct, perfectly legitimate, and gives beautiful results in the context of the old matrix model, which is emphatically not what I will be talking about in this lecture. So I just want to mention this to eliminate the confusion. Of course, the confusion will become deeper once you will see that the theories I will be talking about also have a realization as double scale matrix models, but this is not our interest. But anyway, let me remind you of the story in the old matrix model, because what I will be doing is something quite different. And I think many people, when they think about open closed duality, have this kind of picture in mind. So let me review this intuition. One can prove in concrete examples, which are exactly solvable, that this expansion, so in in some examples of matrix models, or even in cases of matrix quantum mechanics, where you have a one-dimensional quantum field theory rather than a zero-dimensional quantum field theory, you can sometimes compute these things exactly. And one can see very beautifully and very explicitly that there is a critical behavior of this function fg of t. Namely, the function is not analytic where this parameter t, the Tooth coupling, reaches some critical point t critical. That's the place where the sum over planar diagrams for genus zero, for example, in general, the sum over diagrams of the given genus diverges, the series diverges, and at that point you get some non-analytic behavior which is captured by a critical exponent alpha. And quite remarkably, there are arguments you could give this in the continuum. It so happens that the power that multiplies the exponent alpha is 2 minus 2g. The critical point TC is the same for all genera. And so the intuition here is that as you are tuning this parameter T to the critical value, there's a phase transition, and your matrix model is dominated by surfaces with an infinite number of holes. So the approach here is to tune oneself precisely at this critical point, take the Lagrangian limit, and define a renormalized coupling constant kappa by taking n large and tuning to the critical point so that this combination is fixed. And because of this magic that Tc minus T appear with this exponent 2 minus 2g, which is precisely the exponent of n, then of course the whole point of this is that this combination, 1 over kappa, is fixed, and then you can reorganize your partition function as an expansion in powers of kappa, which is now interpreted as our renormalized effective closing coupling constant. And what has happened here is that we have filled the holes literally by taking this mesh to be finer and finer, and the way we should think about the matrix model for finite n is as a discretization of the Riemann surface. So the matrix model with finite n will have, from this statistical mechanics point of view, some non-universal terms we are not really interested in. What we are really interested in is extracting the universal critical behavior that is captured by this double scaling limit. And this is, of course, many of you are probably familiar with all this stuff. I didn't put references, but this is the classic work of several people in the early 90s. This is how one is able to solve non-critical string theories with in small dimension, with central charge, meta-central charge smaller or equal than one. So it so turns out that we will also be interested in this class of theories, but the way we will approach them is as continuum theories. Somebody gave us the exact continuum solution of these theories, which in fact one possible way to obtain is through this route. And we will explore open closed duality in these theories. It has been said that the double scaling limit of the matrix model is an incarnation of open closed duality. And I personally do not understand those claims, and maybe we can talk about that later. I would like, again, as Shiraz, I welcome questions. So anyway, is everybody happy with this so far? Yes.
The fact that you have this divergence in perturbation theory,
yes,
planar perturbation theory, follows, you know, from the fact that the number of graphs with G vertices in planar perturbation theory scales like a power.
That's right. That's right. Yes. I don't really know, of course, but I think it's an interesting question, but I don't think it's really related to what I'm going to say next, in the sense that, as I hope you will agree with what I'm going to say next, what we are really interested in the case of ADS-CFT is the theory for all values of t. or for some values of t, not necessarily for the values of t where the planar perturbation theory is diverging. So this is what I was about to say, that first of all, in ADS-CFT, we would like to understand perhaps the SU3 gauge theory or the SU10 gauge theory. Anyway, n is a parameter. It may be useful and important to get a large n expansion, but certainly in the strong form of the SFT correspondence, we are not sending n strictly to infinity as we do in the double scaling limit. And moreover, t, we also think even more explicitly than n, because we don't really have much control about the quantum correction of the SFT, but we have some more control on t, which as Shiraz was reviewing before, plays the role of the radius of the ADS space. So it's a free geometric parameter of the closed background. Certainly, in the maximally supersymmetric case, we by now I think have believed quite strongly that the background makes sense for all values of t, and we should be able to interpolate, that's what Shiraz was doing before, between values where t is very large to values where t is very small. When t is really large, the description in terms of supergravity in a almost flat background makes sense. And where t is small, we are dealing with something we don't really know, have much control about from the string theory point of view, but there is a weakly coupled gauge theory description. So it looks to me that we are really not doing a double scaling limit in any sense. We are keeping t and n as free parameters, and if we believe in the strong version of the DSFT correspondence, we must be able to understand open causality for every value of t and for every value of n, although, of course, different limits may be useful for different purposes. Does that somehow address your... Then, of course, given that we understand the duality for all values of t or values of n, we may ask now about phase transition, the specific values of t and specific values of n. But at least we should be able to set up the duality for all values of t and for all values of n. So the picture that we are not the first to emphasize, but I think there is, in particular, there's a very nice paper by Oguri and Vafa. So what I would like to sell you is a different point of view about open-closed duality from the one based on condensing several holes on the surface. And the point of view is the following. I would like to understand open-closed duality in some sense locally in the moduli space of Riemann surface. I want to understand open-closed duality surface by surface in the following sense. We'll consider, so in open string perturbation theory, we are instructed to integrate over the moduli space of open surfaces, and let's say we restrict ourselves to a certain genus, and we take a certain number of holes. So, of course, this would be the case for genus 2 and 3 holes. And the way I would like to advocate open causality is working is that given this surface, I keep the genus the same, of course. That's simply the statement that the large n expansion is doing what it's doing. That's what Toft told us. But now the way I go from the open theory to the closed one is by closing the holes one by one. So I'm not condensing the holes. I'm not getting rid of, in the double scaling limit, this diagram is completely immaterial because we are focusing, by taking the double scaling limit, we are focusing on the region of perturbation theory where only diagrams with arbitrary large number of holes contribute. But if we are to make sense of ADS-CFT, if we are to make sense of what Chirac was saying before, we should be able to understand ADS-CFT for t very small, and then this diagram should not be thrown away. So the idea is then somehow summarized by this picture. I have a Riemann surface of a certain region with a certain number of holes, and I close each hole to make up a preferred point of the surface, which is a puncture. Now, so large part of the lecture will be trying to make more precise this idea. So far this is just a cartoon, and you will see shortly that there is actually a precise mathematical sense in which I can relate this picture to this picture. So of course, to make this cartoon a little bit more precise, we should remind ourselves that the number of moduli, so the dimension of, so this was the integration of our moduli space, and in fact, the number of, of the moduli is, counting real moduli, is minus 6 plus 6g plus 3h, whereas here, the number of moduli is minus 6 plus 6g plus 2p, where p is the number of punctures, and I'm telling you that p is equal to h. So clearly here we are missing some moduli, and it's obvious where the moduli that are missing are. They correspond to the sizes of the holes. So if I want to hope to make this correspondence, I need to explicitly integrate over the missing p moduli. So there are some integrations here over rho I. I'm sorry, from here, I'm sorry, on the open side. I want to actually integrate this diagram over, so there are p inter, there are h integrals. I go from 1 to h over the moduli that correspond to the sizes of the holes. And again, this will be made more precise as we go along, but the kind of correspondence that we expect is that if we represent the insertion of a boundary on the surface by the boundary state in the usual operator language, then, well, there is a certain prescription to integrate over this modulus. There are certain Gauss insertion, but I hope now I have made at least plausible, or not completely false, the idea that as I integrate over this extra modulus, I can perhaps hope to map this whole thing, the integral over this boundary state over this extra modulus, to be effectively replaced by a single puncture on the surface. So I've put explicitly in blue a factor of t, because remember that in the Tuft analysis, t was the parameter that was counting for me the number of holes, right? So the t is what helps me keep track of the holes. And then you can see now that things are starting to go the way you want, because of the following. That clearly, so here I'm considering the surface with a fixed number of holes, which becomes a surface with a fixed number of punctures if my cartoon is right. But obviously, I will also need to sum over all the possible number of holes that I have, and there will be a factor of t to the h. And in fact, a little bit of thinking will show you that if the holes are indistinguishable, you better put a 1 over h factorial there. And so this will be converted over an analogous sum over h here. And among the moduli that I'm keeping implicit in the description, the moduli which are here, some of the moduli will certainly correspond to moving the position of this puncture all around the surface. So schematically, again, I will get something like integral over the Riemann surface of some appropriate operator, let me call it W. And of course, what will happen is that this will now exponentiate to something like this. And that's the standard way in which, with a factor of t, actually, is everybody, I mean, I'm assuming that I'm not writing any smaller than Chirac, so everybody's seeing. You should complain if not. So anyway, so this now makes a lot of sense, because this is precisely the way in which you expect to deform the glossy background. So what this operation is doing is shifting the worksheet action by the integration over the whole worksheet of this insertion W. And of course, that's precisely the way in which you expect to deform the conformal field theory, which ties nicely with the idea that in, I guess, all non-examples of IDSFT correspondence and related examples, T is a geometric parameter. It's a parameter of the closing background. So that's the cartoon, and I want to make it more precise. So in the next couple of slides, I will sort of formulate the general setup in general enough words that one can hope that a similar story will carry over to more realistic examples, and then move on to the examples that we really understand, which are matrix models. In fact, there is also a related class of examples which are by now very well understood, which are actually closely related, which are the example of topological string theories. And of course, both in the case of topological string theories and in the case of matrix models, the big advantage is we have complete analytic control, and so we can demonstrate this picture explicitly. And we can argue, and I like, since I'm trying perhaps to state things in the most provocative way, because largely because I believe what I'm saying, but if you don't believe what I'm saying, you should interrupt me, and we can argue whether or not this picture has any chance to survive in more realistic examples like actual, say, n equals 4 square mills in 4 dimensions. So the basic setup is the following. We consider a matrix model, and you're free mentally to substitute gauge theory if you want to be ambitious. And we interpret it as the open string field theory on n d-branes of some appropriate closing theory. So remember that in this famous picture, we were noticing an analogy between these fat graphs, Feynman diagrams in the double line notation, and diagrams of open string perturbation theory. And now what I'm saying is that this is not an analogy, but the precise correspondence. I want to interpret this exactly, precisely, as the Feynman diagram of an open string field theory. So literally, the fat graphs are the open string field theory Feynman diagrams of my open theory. And I'm not taking any decoupling limit. I take the full open string field theory, whatever it is. I'm not decoupling any of the massive modes. It may happen, and in fact it will happen in the concrete case that I will focus on, that the matrix model will contain some parameters, some coupling constants. In fact, to be completely explicit, let me tell you what is the example that we analyze in detail. The example is based on Hermitian n by n matrices, x. So I have a function, an action, which is a function of x, which looks like this. Yeah, it doesn't really matter, actually. I mean, just factors are, at this stage, are not crucial. So this is the celebrated Koncievich model. But all it is for us is a zero-dimensional quantum field theory, a matrix model, where these are emission, both X and Z are Hermitian matrices, and we will be considering integration over Hermitian matrices. So given that the measure is invariant under unitary transformations, we are free to diagonalize this matrix Z so that the everything will only depend on the eigenvalues of Z. So anyway, our theory will depend on some parameters Z from 1 to big N. N is the rank of the gauge group, if you will. Here, plus.
What's between the Z and the plus?
XZX. I'm sorry, I could have written this ZX squared. It doesn't make any difference. I wrote it in that suggestive way because, well, for a reason that will become apparent soon. So anyway, there are some coupling constants in the matrix mod that in this concrete example you can just see what they are. But more generally, you can think of having a gauge theory with some allowed deformations. And we would like to identify these possible deformations as changing the open stream boundary conditions. Of course, in realistic examples, we don't quite know how to do that. So the best thing I can think of is, for example, turning on a non-commutative parameter in a gauge theory. That is one of the few things that we know how to do precisely to describe the deformations of the open stream boundary conditions. And generically, if you try to do something more drastic, something more general, you end up with a gauge theory that you don't really know how to control. But in principle, you can think of doing that. So the gauge theory I have in mind is not necessarily your garden variety trace F-square gauge theory. It may be more complicated, and indeed, I've just given you an example, the case of non-commutative gauge theory, in which it will be considerably more complicated. And the idea is that you have a space of coupling constants which are in correspondence, well, in this case, they are my coupling constants, and I want to think of those as encoding the possible open stream boundary conditions. So a class, a natural class of observables is the open stream partition function, which following exactly the same recipe as I had before, with simply G open replacing G M Mills, can be expanded a la Tuft in the following way. But now there's also a dependence on this open stream moduli Z sub I. But notice that in this example, this is a particularly clean example because there is one modulus for each boundary component. So this is an N by N matrix model. So the way, again, I'm a little bit reluctant to draw this picture because it makes one think about some space-time intuition, which is not really there in these simple examples. But you have a stack of N brains. And what will happen in this example is that each allowed boundary, so the open strings can end now on any of these brains, and each brain has a parameter, has a modulus, which is this Zi. So there are n, big N moduli, because there are big N brains. There are big N possible ways that you can decide your open string boundary, where to place your open string boundary. But anyway, more generally, you can certainly think of perhaps an infinite dimensional moduli space. It doesn't really matter. I'm trying to be general, and of course, having that specific example in mind helps. So there is an expansion of that kind. Well, on the closing side, well, what is the natural observable on the closing side? Well, there will be some closing physical states, okay, and you may organize the complete information about the closing theory into this kind of partition function. You have a genus county parameter G string, and then you simply exponentiate the vertex operators in the usual standard way, so that taking the derivative with respect to the sources decays gives you the correlators. So the statement of open closed duality, as I was advertising it before, is the idea that in the expansion of the closing partition function into diagrams of a certain genus and with a certain number of insertions. So if I take start taking derivative with respect to the decays, I will get, if I take three derivatives, I will get three insertions of my operators, or one, or two, or three, for example. And the idea, again, is that such a diagram can be equivalently computed in the open version, where each, if you will, each puncture is blown up to a boundary. And the way this will work is that, given that my boundary state now carries a certain dependence on the modulus Z, each brain is decorated by Z, this operation of exchanging the boundary with the closing insertion will tell me that I will get a specific linear combination of my closing observable with some coefficients that depends on Z. And the statement of open closed duality is then these two things are equal. I can either compute the vacuum amplitude as a function of this parameter Zi, or the closing amplitude as a function of the source's decay, which has related in this way with the open moduli. And this formula, if you think about it for 2 minutes, is a consequence of this picture. If you buy this picture, then you are left to that formula. Because all you need to do is to compute the full partition function in 2 different ways. If you compute in the open channel, you get the vacuum amplitude as a function of, so now each of these boundaries carry a dependence on the Z's. If you compute in the open channel, you get the left-hand side. And if you compute in the closed channel, I'm replacing holes with punctures, and that is the same as turning on a little bit of sorts for my closing operators. So this is a lot of philosophy, and if there are questions about this, I'm actually going a little bit slower than I was anticipating. Okay, so okay, in these solvable examples, the whole point, of course, that since they're solvable, we can compute both and claim that they're equal. But generically, the open side is vastly simpler for reasons that that will become clear soon. So for this sort of fairy tale to make sense at all, there is a zeroth order check, in some sense, which is, since I'm advocating something that works order by order in string perturbation theory, so incidentally, there's nothing non-perturbative about this. Like, I'm working order by order in string perturbation theory. All the observables I was telling you about are perturbative observables. Then, of course, it's an interesting question to ask how this extends non-perturbatively, but so far I've only been matching perturbative amplitudes. Then, in order for this to make sense, we now must be able to analyze Warshield perturbation theory and check whether this has any sense of working. And one thing works very nicely, namely the fact that the relevant moduli space of Riemann surfaces behave precisely the way they should for this to make sense. So as I was saying before, if you count moduli, there are 6G minus 6 plus 3H open moduli and 6G plus minus 6 plus 2P closed moduli. So there is extra, if I put P equal H, or extra H moduli. And there is a beautiful mathematical isomorphism, which is the following, that the open stream moduli space of Gino Z with Chase Hall is equal to the direct product of R plus to the H, H positive real number times M closed. And this is something that I've sort of, when I give talks about this and I mention this in passing without explaining it, I immediately get objections because nobody believes it. In fact, if you think about it for a second, it seems like a rather implausible fact. Because suppose I have a surface with a certain number of holes, So clearly this extra H moduli on the right-hand side must somehow encode the length of these holes, the boundary length of these boundaries. And surely, one thinks, something must go terribly wrong when, for example, the boundaries collide. Or perhaps, why is it such a trivial product structure? One could certainly imagine to have some non-trivial fibration here. There could be restriction, for example. I specify the length of this boundary and the length of the other boundary. How, I mean, I should not be able to specify a third arbitrary number for this guy. There should be restrictions or whatnot. And in fact, what happens is that, no, there is a completely straightforward and simple decomposition of that kind. And this is a result in somewhat implicit in the work of Penner and Conseil, which I think was the first to really make this statement completely explicit. And in fact, you can endow these spaces with some further mathematical structure. You can put a topology on them. You can compactify the spaces. And whatever structure you can think of, it carries over. So this is an isomorphism for example. These spaces are not quite topological spaces because they're orbital singularities, but never mind. Don't worry, I'm not going to enter into much mathematical detail because I don't fully understand the mathematics, which is quite subtle. But anyway, the claim is that there is such a decomposition. And this is what I'm going to explain next. I want to prove in the physical, in the physics, physicist standard of proof, I want to prove this fact.
But is it at the level of the geometry of the moduli space?
Yeah, I think also the claim is at the level of the geometry of the moduli. Certainly at the level of the topology. Already at the level of the topology, it seems to me a very non-trivial fact that this is true.
Really?
Well, I don't know. I always get objections. Maybe if it's intuitive to you, all the better. But we are going to see why this is true. Okay, so no, that's later. So this, for now, this is a mathematical fact that I can refer you to the mathematical papers, and I will give you a very hand-waving proof shortly. So this is, although my exposition of this may not do full justice to this statement, this is just a mathematical fact. Here, well, of course, I'm putting some spin on the whole story, and I want to say that, well, given this type of decomposition, at least in some favorable examples, what I would like to do is to start, say, from the open side, and since there is this factorization, I will just explicitly integrate over these H numbers, and what's left over is an effective closing theory where I've replaced each hole by a puncture. I'm sorry, what was your question?
You are calculating the partition function on this surface with some operator insertion, and you want to, say, replace it by some other partition function without insertion.
Well, I'm doing something which you have seen many times before. You have a theory with the brains, and then magically I delete the brains, you have the theory with no brains, but with some sources which have been turned on for the closing fields. So that's what this equivalence is. But I want to see this as much as possible at the level of Warshield perturbation theory. I want to somehow make sort of this magic step in which I have the brains on one side of the duality, and then I delete the brains and I turn on sources, I want to make that step a little bit more explicit. Okay, so now we switch technology and we go to the blackboard, and I will probably not be able to finish what I want to say because it takes a few steps, but I want to prove that fact. And even if you don't somehow care about anything else, I'm going to tell you in the next few lectures. I think you should, well, you may be interested, you may still be interested in this fact by itself because it's a beautiful fact. and it's a classic fat. So I want to prove that the composition of the open moduli space into parameters representing the length of the boundaries times the appropriate closing moduli space. So I think the blue doesn't quite work. Okay, so what do we do? We need to get some description of the open moduli space of genus G with H holds. And so let me remind you of a famous mathematical fact that if I have a Riemann, well, first of all, what is this space? Well, it's equivalence class of complex structures, right? So these are my complex structures on the Riemann, on my surface. And it's a famous fact that I'm just reminding of, that given a metric on the surface, you can uniquely determine a complex structure, but clearly the opposite is not true, because given a complex structure, you can only determine an equivalence class of matrix. And of course, it's the famous fact that in two dimensions you can represent locally in each patch your metric as a flat matrix time a Weyl factor given a complex structure, and the complex structure does not fix the Weyl factor. As you vary the Weyl factor, you get the same complex structure but different metrics. So now we want to, so on the other hand, it will turn out to be very useful. So this error, we would like to get a error at that level, which clearly cannot work unless we specify some extra conditions on the type of metric that we want. So that turns out to be the useful step. We will, given the complex structure, we will pick a specific representative in the matrix which are related by Weyl scalings, local Weyl scalings, so that this becomes an isomorphism. So what is the extra condition that turns out to be very useful? We will look not for generic metrics, but for metric. So given the complex structure, we will look for the metric of minimal area. Under the following condition, such that any non-trivial open curve, I don't want to write everything because otherwise, has length greater or equal than some specified number, which convention will pick to be pi. So let's try to understand what this means. I give you a Riemann surface with a certain number of holes and of a certain genus. So first of all, what is a non-trivial open curve? Well, a non-trivial open curve is a curve when it's open, so it must go from one boundary component to another. So a curve that goes from one boundary and ends on the same without circling any other topological obstruction is trivial because it can be shrunk to zero. This curve would be non-trivial, and similarly, for example, a curve that went around a cycle, a non-trivial cycle of this, of a torus, for example, or of whatever, you know what I mean, would also be non-trivial. A curve that went around this and came back could also be non-trivial. So these are non-trivial open curves. And I want to put a metric on my surface, and I want that all non-trivial open curves have length greater than some specified amount. So that intuitively, that tells me that my metric cannot be too small. Because if I lower the value of the metric everywhere, it's eventually I will meet the obstruction that some of my non-trivial curves will have length smaller than pi. And among these admissible metrics which obey this condition, I want to look for the one of minimal area. And in fact, we now use, of course, I'm hiding all the subtleties in by simply quoting theorems. And the theorem says that there exists a unique metric with these properties. So that does the job. So there is a preferred metric such that this becomes an isomorphism. So rather than integrating over complex structures, we can think of given a complex structure, we have a one-to-one correspondent with metrics of this form, we can think of using this description as the more explicit one. And why is this an explicit and useful description? Well, let's try to think about how these metrics look like. So it's actually useful to start with a following warm-up, which turns out actually to be a little bit more than just a warm-up. Let's pick a rectangular region in the complex plane where of height t, say. And let's say that these are my open boundaries, so that my non-trivial, this would be a non-trivial curve, for example. So the question is, what is the metric of minimal area on this surface of the complex plane which obeys my condition? And the answer is, of course, it's the flat metric. No, it's not the torus. These are open. This is an open boundary. And in fact, I'm not even gluing that with that. I'm just, this is not a valid Riemann surface, but I'm just considering this different mathematical problem. Well, clearly this works, because if you pick this metric, it's obvious that, well, this length would be exactly pi, and any horizontal curve which is not straight will have a greater length, so it's an admissible metric. And it's also clearly the one of minimal area, because if you attempt to lower the area anywhere, you are screwed because you fail the length condition. If you attempt to lower the area here, if I go through this point, the length will become smaller than pi. And I also cannot raise the metric anywhere because then I would increase the area. So it's obvious in this example that the flat metric solves the problem. And now with the, And now with a leap of that I leave to your imagination. Well, if given this simple example, the flat metric is the one that solves the problem, well, I think it's pretty intuitive, or at least it could be justified more precisely, but it's pretty intuitive that my open Riemann surface will have to be built out of these fundamental ingredients. So locally, my open Riemann surface will look like flat strips of length pi. Well, clearly, the metric cannot be flat everywhere because, well, we know from the integral over square root gr is related to the Euler number, so there's an topological obstruction for the metric to be flat everywhere. But in fact, the next best thing that you can do is the metric to be flat almost everywhere, except at some conical singularities. And in fact, it turns out that the metrics of minimal area are of the following form. They're built out of flat strips of length pi in such a way that anytime the strip, you can have, the strips can meet at cubic vertices or higher. And anytime the strips meet, let's consider the example of a cubic overlap. Suppose that this is the point P, this is A, B, and C. This picture doesn't really make justice to the thing, because what I really mean here is that this is P, these are my three strips, P, 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 and I'm gluing. So I'm gluing this boundary with this boundary, and so on cyclically. So clearly there is a total angle of 3 pi at that center point. And similarly for higher vertices, you just glue symmetrically my open strips. So if you think about it a little bit, it's, one can convince oneself, and maybe not prove, but certainly convince oneself, that if you try to glue things differently, you violate these requirements. So, very good. So, given a complex structure, so given an element of the open C moduli space, we have associated to it a preferred metric, and when we endow the surface with that metric, the surface looks built out of flat strips which meet at conical singularities like that. Well, of course, yeah, the handles, well, of course, this continues, right? So eventually we'll have to close your strips. So if you take something which has no open punctures, I need to close everything, right?
But why don't those degenerate?
So what happens with them? What, it happened that the handles are here. Maybe, I'm not sure if I will be able to really do an example with handles, but you can certainly try, right? You can have, this is actually a lot of fun once you get addicted to it. But you can now build up, well, every time the diagram is non-planar, you are drawing it on a higher genus surface, right? So so what would be the simplest example of a non-planar? Which loop?
The width you want to be pi, but why not make its length? The loop user, there's only one loop, right?
Here? This loop?
Yeah. Why don't you just take that to zero? Or do you?
Can you change the context of the
framework? Yeah, that's right. So anyway, the question we have is, anytime you cannot draw the surface on a sphere, then it is as if you had a higher genus surface with a certain number of holes. And that is one element, you know, of course, fix the complex structure on this higher genus surface, and there is unique such diagram. So let me not attempt to draw things that I'm not very good at drawing. But let me try to get to the punchline of at least of this first part. So that gives us a completely explicit description of the moduli space. In which the modular parameters are encoded in the lengths of these strips. So there's, again, minus 6 plus 6g plus 3h, such parameters. And let's actually consider the simplest possible example, which is genus 0 and h equal to 3. That is, of course, a sphere with 3 holes, and I should need a lot of space for this. So the dimension of this moduli space is clearly 3. And what are the diagrams that you can draw? Well, they are the following. It's bigger. Okay, let's try to see if people can see. So first of all, you can number the holes. So let's say this is 1, 2, and 3. So each hole corresponds clearly to a boundary component of this is a possible graph, but then of course since I'm numbering the the boundary components, I can do 1, 3, 2, or I can do 2, 3, 1. But I'm not done, clearly. One other diagram that I can draw is this one, some kind of flock like that, which is still 1, 2, 3, and 3. Let me, takes a long time to draw, but clearly there are these other diagrams just differ by the labeling. So these are four. These are points where there's four strips joining this, and then finally there is this diagram, which is of a different nature. And the T's here are the lengths of the strips. So let's say this is T1. This is T2. Well, I picked these names. Never mind. This is now T3. So alternatively, perhaps, a better choice of coordinates would be to label the graphs by the lengths of the boundary components. So here, boundary component 1 has just length T2. Boundary component 2 has length T3. That's why my choice of name is not particularly fortunate, but never mind. And boundary component 3 has length T2 plus T1 plus T3. T1 is this one, T2 is this one, and T3 is, maybe I should use different colors, but the boundary components, this is called 1, this is called 2, and the external one is called 3. And the T's, this is T2, this is T from, these are the, remember that the T's go from different vertices, right? So T2 goes around, T1 goes from here to here. I don't know.
The L's are the length of the boundaries?
Sorry?
The L's are the length of the boundaries.
The L's are the length of the boundaries. No, you don't think about it that way. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I think you're right. I'm sorry. Yes, you're right. Well, yeah, I think you're right. Yes. Yeah, you're right. It contributes twice. So this is T2 T1 plus Okay, I need to hurry up a bit. So the point of drawing this very explicitly is that now we can, so this is the composition of the moduli space. Actually, decomposes the moduli space in cells. So each of these diagrams represents a cell in the decomposition of the moduli space, and you can sort of see how the cells flow into one another. So in going from here, so in this case, L3 clearly is bigger than the sum of L2 plus L1. But in going from here to here, you can do it by, if you now pick L1, L2, L3 as your coordinates, if you reduce L3, eventually you are setting this length smaller and smaller, and eventually the surface gets here. And if you keep reducing L3, you get here. Now, in flowing from here to here, what I can do, for example, is increase L2. And as I keep increasing L2, I'll end up here, and so forth and so on. So you can sort of see that this cell here is in the middle of moduli space. You can flow through it by passing through one of these surfaces, which has a vertex of valence 4. So it's also clear that this, so from this, the point of going through these simple examples in some detail is that these are clearly of measured 0. you need to, they are codimension one in the moduli space. So the point of showing that these were of measure zero is that now, with another leap.
So the bottom one is even higher codimension?
No, the bottom one is a legitimate piece of the moduli space. So the bottom one, each vertex here is cubic, and the bottom one is such that the L's obey triangle inequalities, strict triangle inequalities. Here, L3 is bigger than the sum, but here the boundary components obey a triangle inequality. So I need to move on a bit. But of course, although this is not the historic path, once you have got this far, it's obvious that this is the Feynman diagram expansion of a field theory, of a string field theory, where my flat strips are thought of as open string propagator. The T's are Schwinger parameters. And how does the open string field theory look like? Well, let's remind ourselves with another little bit of leap that for each we are in string theory, for each modulus, we are instructed to put a B insertion, which in these coordinates, which just look like we integrate B of sigma across the horizontal strip. So it's clear that the string field theory action is psi C0 L0 psi plus psi 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 in some schematic notation. So the reason that I don't need any higher vertices is that, as I was showing here explicitly, the cubic vertices are enough to generate this diagram for specific submanifolds of when the Schwinger parameters take some specific values, these are just a subsector of diagrams generated by the cubic interaction term. And so the reason why this is C0, L0 is because by inverting this vertex operator, you get B0 over L0, which by the usual Schwinger trick, you represent in this fashion. And if I now think in the operator for, in the Hamiltonian interpretation, L0 is the open string Hamiltonian. And so what L0 is doing is propagating me by some worksheet time, T. And that's how the strips are built. So as usual in a field theory, the Feynman diagrams come from the gauge fixed version. And so this is the gauge fixed version of the action, which is Witten's action, where instead of C0, L0, you have the BRST operator, which starts like C0, L0 plus dots. And if you impose the condition that B0 psi kills the state, you get this field theory. And of course, I could have phrased things in the opposite conceptual direction. Somebody gives you a field theory. You gauge fix, you derive your propagator and your Feynman rules, which is clearly just a cubic vertex. And that gives you these diagrams. And so this is the, with a lot of leaps, this is a proof that Witten string field theory reproduces perturbative amplitude of string theory. Because the Feynman diagrams cover moduli space exactly once, with the correct Gauss insertions. So I went a bit slow, but I think I should stop because I'm out of time. But so let me summarize. So the goal is to eventually prove this decomposition, GH equal to R to the H times. So I want to prove this. And the first step in proving is giving an explicit description of the open string moduli space, which is the one given by the cell decomposition of cubic string field theory. Okay, that's it. I'm sorry, there are, of course, it's time for questions.